everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Noelle Yasso, and here's your 90-second public interest update to start the program. First, for anyone who's going to be in or near Chicago this November, you may want to check out the Nonprofit Storytelling Conference, running November 10th through 11th. Go to nonprofitstorytellingconference.com for some great video and other online resources to help you use stories to raise awareness or funds for your organization or cause. Speaking of stories, check out NPR.org's special series, Staving Off Eviction, about Washington, D.C.'s housing court. The series highlights how renters and families are caught between too high rents and substandard living conditions and live under the very real threat of eviction. For listeners in New York City, Legal Services NYC, which provides low-income New Yorkers with free civil services, is touting that their legal clinic is open every Thursday during standard business hours. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention that Penn Law's own Service Veterans Legal Assistance Project is now helping U.S. veterans in need of discharge upgrades and VA benefits and claims assistance. Visit www.law.upenn.edu/public-service for more info. And let's end our news update with an impressive statistic from our friends at LawWorks in London, which provides pro bono legal help to individuals and communities in need. More than 4,500 lawyers and law students volunteered across the LawWorks Clinics Network in 2015. And now, on to our interview.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. I'm Emily Sutcliffe, and today we're thrilled to have Bahir Azmi with us. Bahir is the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights and is currently on leave from his faculty position at Seton Hall Law School. Bahir, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I've had a great visit at Penn today.
All right, so just to kind of jump right in there, can you tell us a bit about what brought you to a career in civil and constitutional rights?
Well, I actually entered law school thinking I wanted to do more domestic policy work. This was in the early Clinton era, so I was kind of attracted to kind of sort of wonky DC policy solutions like healthcare and jobs programs, and I even got a master's in public administration. But once I got to law school and studied and became connected to issues of systematic injustice, predominantly kind of racial injustice in our criminal justice system, gender discrimination, and those kinds of issues, I kind of forgot everything that I had intended to do before and got drawn into wanting to fight in these arenas. And the more kind of exposure I got, either doing public defender work during a summer internship or doing capital defense work in a summer internship, the more I saw that troubled me with the system. I think a lot of people seem to think law school makes you more conservative. It had the entirely opposite effect on me because, you know, I could use sort of legal tools to confront these injustices that were largely, I could see, framed by privilege, entitlement, discrimination, and that exposure angered me far more than I would have imagined. And I still, in my everyday work, see those same dynamics that I feel compelled to combat.
It's amazing, and I think that will resonate with so many of our students. Yeah. So just to touch on a very specific case that you worked on, President Obama recently announced a plan to shut down Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. So as a clinical law professor, you represented a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay who was ultimately released. Having worked on such a case and having visited Guantanamo on several occasions, what are your reactions to the president's recent announcement?
My reaction might not be what a lot of people expect who are supporters of President Obama. I think the plan is in a way too late and in a way too little. I think it's too late because virtually everything he mentioned in the plan, including the really easiest steps like releasing detainees who have been cleared for release, some of whom have been cleared since 2009. that could have happened a long time ago. So, you know, I'm heartened that they're making a commitment to release the remaining 35 this year. But that should have happened a long time ago. And the only reason it didn't is, I believe, not obstruction from Congress, but a lack of political will from this administration. It's also too little in some respects, because a central feature of the plan is simply to move Guantanamo to the United States. And I agree with the president when he says Guantanamo is a betrayal of American values, but the betrayal doesn't turn on the just pure physical space that Guantanamo inhabits. It turned on the legal and political space, one that was constructed to deny people rights, and the one that permits something that is fairly alien to our constitutional tradition, flawed as it is, and to our avowed commitment to human rights, which is the idea of simple indefinite detention without end based on the, you know, president's say-so. And for him to bring detainees here for continued indefinite detention, I think risks normalizing the practice within domestic U.S. soil, and it risks expanding it for a future president who might use whatever detention facility to indefinitely detain people picked up anywhere in the world. Or potentially to be used against other deeply disfavored groups who are deemed not allowed to have rights.
Right. So in many cases, it sounds like not righting a wrong, but kind of transferring it to perhaps a less visible arena.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a way in which literally closing Guantanamo would fulfill his promise, but not if you scratch beneath the surface, because the essence of Guantanamo, again, is its experimentation with, you know, American and international human rights legal principles. And I should say the Obama administration, unfortunately, has been very much responsible for perpetuating and legitimizing in ways some of that experimentation. So, for example, they have refused to bring any criminal prosecutions against individuals who have committed war crimes, as detailed in the Senate report, in excruciating detail. They have sought to dismiss all cases seeking accountability against Bush administration officials for torture and arbitrary detention, extraordinary rendition. And they have taken litigation positions very similar to the Bush administration in resisting the habeas corpus rights that individual detainees try to assert. As a result, in opposing all of these cases, we've created law in the very conservative D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which was, you know, at least in the time that this law was happening, very far to the right of the Supreme Court, where there is no legal recourse anymore through the courts. Lawyers have abandoned the courts in large part in litigating for clients because the D.C. Circuit has said the thinnest of evidence, the thinnest of guilt by association evidence is good enough for these terrorists. And that is a decision that the Obama administration made that didn't have to and continues to make in some very dramatic and disturbing cases.
So what do you make of a president who by many is understood to be very liberal, kind of taking these very stereotypically conservative, hardline, some would say draconian stances mm-hmm. against certain American populations? Mm-hmm.
I think the answer lies in part more with the office of the presidency than the person who inhabits it. And I would say, you know, he definitely deserves some credit. He shut down the torture program. And for our clients in Guantanamo, conditions there are better than they had been before. But there's something about which I think he must have learned the kind of realpolitik of national security law and practice in Washington, D.C. And the president is not entirely in charge. And, you know, I think there are a number of examples of that. You know, I think early on in his administration, he might have been ambivalent about punishing the CIA for the torture program, ambivalent about the CIA's state secrets defense to dismiss cases. And I think he heard very loud and clear from CIA directors, don't you dare come after us. And not to be melodramatic, but in so many words, we'll destroy you. You know, so there's kind of a deep state function here that limits the president's choices to some extent. I think had he had the political will during the right moment, he could have overcome it. But he had other priorities, and he recognized the political risk in moving some of this stuff forward, and the original vision, I think, evaporated. Mm-hmm. Remember, Woodrow Wilson was also a progressive constitutional scholar and president of Princeton University, and when he became president, he requested and oversaw some of the most repressive pieces of legislation. The Anti-Espionage Act, et cetera, that was designed specifically, this constitutional law scholar who extolled free speech, these statutes were designed to suppress dissension over World War I. And I think that's relevant to our understanding of our role, because you cannot expect the person to do everything you want. And I think even Obama understands this. Civil society, civil rights groups need to hold institutions of power accountable.
And you spoke about the deep state, kind of bringing us to your current work with the Hassan versus the City of New York case, a federal lawsuit filed against the City of New York, challenging really the staggering levels of surveillance of Muslim Americans mm-hmm. conducted by the New York Police Department after 9/11. Can you tell us a little bit about that case and where it's at presently?
Sure. So in 2011, a series of ultimately Pulitzer Prize winning reports, the AP disclosed that the NYPD had a massive program to, quote, map all Muslim communities in New York and New Jersey, and was undertaking a vast program of utterly suspicionless, underscore suspicionless surveillance of all aspects of Muslim life in New York and New Jersey. And they did so on the kind of theory, pseudoscience theory of radicalization that was part of the kind of legal culture in the NYPD that imagines that any young male Muslim who becomes more religious is a threat, which is why you could justify in their mind suspicionless surveillance. It was developing a proxy between religious belief and suspicion. Not evidence of suspicion itself. So with our partners, Muslim Advocates, they actually initiated the lawsuit. We later joined the CCR. We challenged the legality of the surveillance program as a discriminatory surveillance program. It's okay for police officers to, you know, walk the beat and look at businesses, of course. It's not okay for police officers to select as their only criteria for doing that religion. And we lost in the district court in a really worrying decision that was resonant of the reasoning in Korematsu by sort of simply accepting the government's justification that national security required the suspicionless surveillance and failing to apply the strict scrutiny that's supposed to come out of our modern legal jurisprudence. A very worrying decision, but on appeal – that decision was reversed in a kind of resounding Third Circuit opinion that recognized that surveillance of Muslims is stigmatizing and injurious on its own, citing Brown versus Board of Education, and really connecting this program in affirmative, powerful ways to historical patterns of exclusion, discrimination, and violence. It's Jews and the Red Scare, African Americans and the Civil Rights Movement, and most emphatically Japanese Americans during World War II, and counseled us to learn lessons from those historical moments. It was a really significant, I think, victory for Muslim civil rights in this country.
Yeah. And so kind of thinking especially about Japanese-American internment and all of these other historical moments that you referenced, many Muslim Americans today report feeling less safe, more targeted in the U.S. than they did after 9/11. Yeah. And many report feeling that kind of this return to internment-like conditions is not something completely out of the realm of possibility in the future. What are your reactions to kind of real people's feelings, people who aren't, attorneys necessarily, but just living as Muslim Americans?
I think it's very real. I think there's an extremely worrying climate of Islamophobia is connected to other kinds of phobias. I mean, sort of the obviously the Republican candidates are demonizing immigrants as well, and they are of a piece to the extent that during wartime and economic insecurity that we ourselves created, of course, that othering becomes more natural and more destructive. And naturally, when this kind of rhetoric is either not consistently challenged, it is validated, and when it's validated, people can act on it. And that is at the level of private discrimination. I would and violence, and real violence, and violence towards Muslims. In the past 15 years, has so 9/11 aside. Since then, has so exceeded violence committed by Muslims. And that's not a reality people recognize. But even when it comes to these kind of surveillance of Muslim communities, what we're regularly hearing is a kind of a feeling that these law enforcement entities are sort of engaging in a kind of psychological warfare, because what's happening in these communities is they have no idea if the person next to them who is befriending them is friend or foe. And that is – I don't know if that's intentional or just a byproduct of this. I think to the extent that these techniques were used, infiltration techniques with other kind of radical movements, Black Panthers, labor movements, I wonder if it's intentional. But in any event, it has had that effect on Muslim communities, which is a very important spiritual community for Muslims. And we have to figure out what ways to end it.
It's interesting because we talk about this kind of Muslim Americans being suspicious of people in their mosque and not knowing who they can trust. And then we're also seeing this large kind of push and messaging to say, well, the Muslim next door who looks normal, who seems liberal, maybe you cannot trust them either. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see these kind of two populations both experiencing this same kind of psychological warfare.
Right. I mean, the othering is so comprehensive that we can't win. And that's why I sort of brought up how destructive the kind of radicalization theory of the NYPD was in fueling these surveillance tactics, because in their view, there is, kind of latent jihadization, their term, in potentially anyone. There's absolutely no evidence that religiosity as such connects to violence. In fact, the best studies suggest the opposite. It's a form of very sort of easy profiling and scare tactics that we've seen before. The sort of notion that there's a fifth column here in the United States that is often parallel with foreign wars, and we have to think about our role in conducting wars, and how that can create hostile civil rights climate, not to mention destruction on the ground where we're engaging in the wars.
I'd love some of your parting thoughts on realistic steps that we can all take to ensure that all Americans, really, not just Muslims, but have access to the civil and constitutional rights that mm-hmm. this country was founded on.
I think, you know, it's a hard question, but I think if I'm talking to a law school community, I think we should think beyond merely sort of scoring kind of court victories here and there, and start thinking about how to facilitate the kind of coalition building that's happening organically in communities. Not lead it, because lawyers can't lead that stuff. They're not organizers. They don't have the vocabulary. They don't experience the injustice in the way that communities do. But to think about creative ways to support the organizing and activism and coalition building of communities, and to think creatively about building coalitions across traditional areas. You know, to think about, as has happened, Palestine and Black Lives Matter, or, you know, the African American Islamic Muslim community and the sort of immigrant Muslim community. It's going to take some work. Lawyers can't do it themselves, but thinking creatively about how to support that will be really important in what I'm sure will be a kind of long-term process, because there are no easy fixes when an entire class of people is deemed a second class of people.
That's right. Well, really, thank you so much. It's been a privilege to have you join our Penn Law community today. I hope we can keep this ongoing relationship with you and with your center. If you, the listener, want to hear more about the broad range of CCR's work, visit their website, ccrjustice.org, and sign up for their newsletters.
Thank you, Emily. It's been a real pleasure.
This podcast was produced by the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Learn more about public interest lawyering at law.upenn.edu/public service. Thanks for joining us.